I'm Kevin Davis, and this is the Catholic Family Podcast, and I am very happy and honored today to be joined by Father Stephen McKenna. And I have to say before we get started that Father McKenna has been the most patient guest of all time on this show. He has been through so much trouble with technical issues, as everyone knows we go through fairly often, and he's really stuck with us, and I really appreciate that he's sticking with us to give us his story of how he came to the priesthood. And I think, again, as we had on Father Le Taranta recently for a show as well, I think it's really important to get to know our priests. Where did they come from? I think it's good to know kind of that they're humans. They're doing the best they can to help lead us to heaven and bring us the sacraments and the Holy Mass. And I think it's often inspiring to hear where they came from because, well, they were kids and normal people like all of us and then chose the path, the higher path, a higher vocation to the priesthood. So Father McKenna, thank you so much again for your patience and for coming on. And wherever you want to start, please take off.
All right. Well, actually, I was born as an adult. No, I'm just kidding. So I was a kid once. And I was born and raised in Massachusetts, a small town called Tewksbury, Massachusetts. And growing up, we were Irish from the Boston area, so you check the Catholic box, but weren't really church going people. Just growing up basically sort of like a normal regular kid life, if you will, that I had played sports all through school and everything, football, baseball. And then when I was about 17, 18 years old, I met some people that that would become friends of mine, and they ran a nonprofit organization through our local Catholic Church and the Diocese of Boston. I became friends with them, and they would do things that I would want to go to, and it'd be, having a barbecue, but we're also going to go to Mass on Sunday beforehand, or we're going to do this thing, we'll pray the rosary. And so those things sort of, those good influences became me doing them on my own at that time, me starting to take my faith really seriously, started volunteering for that nonprofit organization.
And how old were you at this time, Father? Sorry.
Senior high school, about 18 or so. Okay. So, and then, with that, it was, once that ball started rolling, it progressed pretty quickly. And in hindsight, looking back at it now, at the time going through it, it just seemed like, oh, you made friends and this is what you started doing. But in hindsight, looking back on it now, I could see that, I really was looking for truth, looking for something more than just myself and the status quo of life and whatever going on, the next baseball game that I had to go to and working on those things and thinking about things greater than that. What happens if you die? What happens if you, how did everything come to be? All of those type of questions. And so that's, I think, part of what allowed me to be open to really searching to try to find the faith. And I was, whatever was the truth is what I wanted. And so I'm with these friends at a certain point along the way, we were introduced to the Latin Mass. Actually, it was sort of interesting. There was a couple of people that I knew that were at a Christian bookstore, and the lady just walked up. I don't know how this ends up working well, but no pretenses, no social graces, just says to them, "You should go to the Latin Mass." And instead of being like, you're crazy, you need to stay a distance away from me, please. They said, what's the Latin Mass? And the lady goes, well, it's the Mass that all the saints went to. And then she walked away. And my friends that were there, they started thinking, well, maybe we should look at this thing if all the saints went to it. And that's how we ended up finding the Latin Mass and going. And the first time I went, I just was floored by it. I couldn't believe what we had been missing essentially up to that point. It was so beautiful.
Do you think while you said that you kind of were still searching for the truth at this time, even before you met these friends, was that something, do you think, was that because of even a minuscule Catholic raising? Was it kind of, is it something your parents instilled? Is it just something that's within you? I mean, why do you think you were searching for truth?
Yeah, I would say it's a combination of a couple things. One, certainly, I have to give credit where credit's due to my parents on that. Especially, I mean, both of them really, but especially my father. My father always, since I was a boy, always instilled in me to do the right thing, like regardless if it's popular or not, regardless if other people are doing it or not. If it's right, then, and you know it's right, then stand by and, you know, do what's right. You know, he always taught me to be very honest, very, you know, to really kind of instill sort of like that masculine, manly, you know, virtue on at least the natural level, that that we do what's right because it's right, and we tell the truth because that's, we're supposed to be men of integrity, and we're supposed to X, Y, and Z. And so that certainly was part of that, that I would look for something, if something didn't add up, that I would be willing to sort of look for where the answer actually was, rather than just because somebody told me. Then secondarily, I think, yeah, there's that sort of like cultural Catholic aspect to it, you know, you that in Boston, that you just, you know, part, you know, you always have that in the back of your head, the little bits of the faith that you have. And then thirdly, you know, it's interesting. I'll give credit to a very strange source in that, when I was in high school, one thing about being very honest with myself was that I knew I cannot draw a picture to save my life. I cannot draw. I barely can color inside the lines.
Makes two of us.
Yeah. So I really wanted to avoid taking an art class. And I went to my counselor and I said, how do I not take art? I don't want to take art. I stink at it. And it's a waste of my time. And so, you know, it involved taking, you know, an extra semester of a language, and like, there's a way around it, but I had to take other classes basically. And one of those classes ended up being, of all things, a theater class. And while I just thought it would be like this strange kind of weird thing, that it was definitely weird for me because, you know, being an athlete my entire life growing up, you know, to all of a sudden to jump into sort of like a totally different realm of people, which was like the theater crowd, you know, seemed kind of foreign. But I'm like, okay, well, if it doesn't mean I don't have to draw a picture, I can do that. And during the class, while they taught you like how to act and how to, you know, do different skits and everything, what it really ended up doing was teaching me how to not, like, to let go of caring about, you know, what other people actually really thought at all, you know, that it was just let you be sort of yourself, let you build up some self-confidence in being something that doesn't fit necessarily into the cookie cutter mold that people have set out for you. And by that, it allowed me to not only be friends with people from all different, you know, social, like the little niches that you find in a public school in high school, but it also allowed me to really like to embrace that sort of, you know, even if other people think I'm strange for doing this, meaning certain, like starting to go to church and take my faith seriously, I don't care, you know, that and so that's, so I think those are three sort of influential things that really led me to start exploring down that pathway.
Well, it's interesting, Father. And so do you think that the experience in the theater, and I guess with drama, did that have an impact on how the Latin Mass affected you, or was that more spiritual? Because I think obviously there is more pure, you know, beautiful drama, you know, in the Latin Mass, at least. I've never gone to the Novus Ordo, so I can't really say, but I would imagine that's the case. So is that something you think impacted you?
No, I don't think from that side of it, because, you know, the stuff in the theater that we did do musicals theater, but it was, you know, kind of that, you know, more contemporary musical theater. So you have a little bit of appreciation for that stuff. But if there was an appreciation of art that came early on, it was, you know, from things that were more like, I had a, I had a teacher, for instance, in elementary school. She, Miss King was her name, and she was, I think, my third grade teacher. And she would encourage us to go to watch and see things like, well, for instance, we all got to go see the Phantom of the Opera, which was one, and that, which is, yes, it's a musical, but at least it included some classical aspects to it. We went to the Nutcracker Ballet and things like that. So that started that crack of opening the door towards that appreciation of art. And then when I was in high school, I had a teacher who knew of the Mozart effect for classical music and study. And so every time we had a test, every time we had an examination, he would play classical music for us. And so that was another segue into appreciating art more. And so there was smaller amounts of that it were taking place for sure throughout growing up. But really, I just think that the Latin Mass, its beauty stood out on its own, that it was, you know, there's little bits that allowed me to appreciate it more. But I think just even if I hadn't had those, I think I still would have been really just, I think there is the essence of beauty is a real thing, that there is objective beauty in the world that even somebody who has never witnessed it before or seen it before can appreciate it, those things, those aspects for being beautiful. And the Latin Mass is certainly one, you know, it's one of those things that has a lot of that in it. But whether either be the low mass in that quiet, you know, solemn, prayerful atmosphere, or the high mass with all the bells and whistles and the smoke and the incense and the choir and everything. You know, the first mass I did go to was a high mass, and that was so it was even more powerfully instilled in me. As you know, I think the beauty of the liturgy, especially in its expanded, you know, like its full form, is really something that is just really a conversion tool in and of itself. It had that beauty that I walked in and my jaw dropped as we were going through. And I knew that this is what I wanted to go to, the Novus Ordo, even though there was a period of time where I went back and forth between the two, because it wasn't always convenient to get to the Latin Mass. There's that period of time of going to both of them. Every time I went to the Novus Ordo, I always wanted to be at the Latin Mass. And it was kind of like a poor substitution, which later on would know that it was more than a poor substitution, obviously. So
is that something that the Novus Ordo seemed just inferior to the superior Latin Mass, or was it kind of something that you were even kind of, did you want to, I don't know, do away with the Novus Ordo if you could? Was it something that you kind of wished for, but you just couldn't because you couldn't attend too often?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it happened pretty quick that I appreciated that, that even without really understanding the theological significance of it, that you know, it was pretty easy to be like, why did we ever change from this? This was way better. Why did we ever get rid of it? And so that part of it was pretty easy, I think. In a relatively speaking short period of time, it really opened up the door for us to, me and my friends, to start doing research and to learn what had happened in the church and the why the changes actually came in. And then once you start cracking that egg, you really start to want to have nothing to do with the Latin Mass at all. And
by this time, Father, were you in college or?
Yes.
Or were you at the time? Yeah.
Well, yeah, the first time I went, I was still a senior in high school, but you know, yeah, by the time we started really realizing that, you know, the problems and stuff like that, I was in college. So, that was where we start to really put the pieces together at that point in time. So, because I remember when I was in college, to begin with, I still would occasionally go to the Latin to the Novus Ordo Mass, but I would like this, like a hold your nose and just go because you're like a long distance away from the next Latin Mass. So,
sure.
But after a little while, that stopped. So.
And so, Father, I know that I did an interview with one of your parishioners, Jeremy, a couple of weeks ago, and he was mentioning that you ended up doing some work in real estate. So how did you go from high school playing baseball? And I've got to ask, Father, too, are you a New England Patriots fan?
Yes, I am. I mean,
we have to end this interview. Sorry, Father. I got to go.
Nice. Well, Broncos, okay.
That's hard for me. That's hard for me. And Red Sox, too. Red Sox, the one time my baseball team got to the World Series, had to be the Red Sox. But so Father, where did you go? What happened after through college? What was your path at the time?
Okay. So, I guess it probably starts, if I could, just slightly before the start of college, because, I had actually, we talk about, you know, like learning things along the way. And I think that's important. So, I had started volunteering for this nonprofit organization. And, it was, when I was going to college, my initial application was actually as pre-med. I wanted to be a doctor. A medical doctor so that was my original entrance into college. But then one of the things that happened with me when I started going at, like, started to learn about my faith and start taking it a little bit more seriously, I was like all in, 100% headlong in there. And in doing so, you know, I ended up doing things that were really impulsive, really looking back on it, imprudent, but things that ended up working out in the long run. So, you know, when I was going to enter college, I switched from pre-med to philosophy because, you know, I've been going to church for 6 months now. I'm definitely supposed to be a priest. And so, so I thought philosophy would help out in that way. So I switched to a philosophy major. 2 years in, my mom, you know, very kind of like subtly and gently said, what are you going to do with a philosophy degree if you don't become a priest? And I'm like, that's a legitimate question. And she said, just take a second major. And so I kind of did one of those, you know, dropped the finger down and chose criminal justice. So I ended up graduating with those two degrees, criminal justice and a bachelor's in criminal justice and a bachelor's in philosophy. And also at the same time, because I had started volunteering for that nonprofit organization, made the extremely rash decision of not playing baseball. Again, a decision that worked out in the long run, because who knows what kind of corrupting influences that would have had, no matter, you know, what would have ended up happening after college or anything. But yeah, I was, most kids don't, you know, like, you have the pie in the sky idea of becoming a Major League Baseball player, like every, you know, boy out there pretty much. Mm-hmm. But then the more realistic goal that I had from the time that I could walk was to play collegiate baseball. And then, you know, I actually had it in hand and was, you know, like that was going to become a reality. And then I just kind of like, nah, it's going to take up too much time, which was true. And I wouldn't be able to do the stuff that I was more interested now in doing with the faith, with the church and stuff. So again, it was to my poor family, it seemed just like all over the map, but ultimately it was, they were the right choices. I wouldn't take them back. And, it worked out in the end. So then fast forward, bachelor's in philosophy, bachelor's in criminal justice. While I was going to college, I was working landscaping and general labor for, a major commercial real estate company, Cummings Properties in Woburn, Massachusetts. When I graduated, I knew I didn't want to, you know, do landscaping with my degree. You know, I did go to school to not utilize it to some degree of purpose. And so
did you, sorry, real quick, Father, did you have a plan with the criminal justice? I think it's I think it's kind of ironic that you're a priest with a criminal justice degree, because I just think that's so fitting, because in a way you really do have you kind of work in criminal justice, you know, in the confessional at least.
That is true.
It probably helps you. I imagine philosophy and criminal justice, I bet you that's a pretty good mix for a priest.
It really was. I mean, the philosophy that we learned in college was a lot of modern philosophy, mm-hmm. but what I think it did was really facilitate me well in studying scholastic philosophy. First off, because I was studying scholastic philosophy on my own to formulate arguments with professors regular basis in my classes and things like that. And so that was an important aspect that I was studying already on my own. I also think that one of the biggest hurdles for people in really learning philosophy, like true philosophy, and studying that is the verbiage. It's like its own lexicon for it, which can be very confusing at times, as well as switching your brain to think in more of that abstracted, logical, formulation type of way. And so the philosophy that I got in university certainly set me up well moving forward for those things. And like I said, I had already introduced to myself to scholastic philosophy by my own studies and things like that. It was more, and it did help to some degree to be able to know how to, utilize logic and reasoning and things like that when critical thinking for that part of it. And then the criminal justice, yeah, it's true. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that falls under, like we'd have like classes in forensic psychology, and there'd be crossovers in that. Not that you run into a lot of psychopaths on your day-to-day basis, but it's but there is a lot of better understanding of human nature that I think that comes from a lot of those things, studying crime and cases and typology and all of that. I think really assists in being able to comprehend and understand the way humans act and the way humans are, and the differences and similarities between man throughout society. And like one instance that I thought was really a pretty profound thing was a few years ago, I had gone back to Massachusetts for a couple of days to see some family. And I went out to brunch with a friend of mine that I had since I was a little kid, all the way through high school. He ended up going to law school and becoming, I think he's, last I saw, when I saw him, he was the assistant district attorney for the Commonwealth. And wow. And he was in charge of the state's prosecution of the basically like violent sexual based crimes, really kind of like the really dirty kind of nasty stuff that that takes place. And so, sitting down with him, it's interesting to have two, to have two guys that like knew each other when we were in preschool, to be able to sit down now, both as as men of some level of learning, and to have the like a kind of a conversation in that way where it was really like a thought-provoking conversation. And the first thing he asks me when we sat down, he says, "So as a priest, what was the what do you think is one of the most profound things that you've learned in your years as a priest?" And I started thinking, and there's a couple points that I made, but one of the most important ones was that understanding of human nature. And I said that, the world wants you to believe that man is inherently good, but realistically, we're actually inclined towards evil. And when you understand that and you really actually put it into practice and really, view through that lens, then it's really important understanding human nature, because then when people really do wrong, you can at least empathize with that, because you can understand how that it's, that it's only by act of the will and by grace that we fight against temptations when they come, and that, one person's temptation might be, different than another person's, but it's still common, and that it's something that we have to fight against. And so when someone falls, whether they fall in a great way or a small way, well, at least I can understand why you can understand why they fell and be sympathetic towards that, empathetic towards that, because it's common to all people. And so I think that was a good example of, because he said the same thing, that he couldn't have done his job if he didn't come to the peaceful acceptance that all man is inclined towards doing evil. He said, if you're going after these predators, all you would want to do is just like almost like take personal vengeance upon them. You know, like when you're seeing all the horrible things that they were doing to like kids and, you know, all the child trafficking and everything like that, that he was dealing with on a regular basis. He said, sure. But, you know, like to be able to do your job, you have to sort of somehow understand how they got to that point. And you know, that's the kind of the realization that he had to himself come to. So it was that good sort of example of where the two systems, really overlap in understanding, I think, is that understanding of human nature. And I think there is a lot to be said for understanding human nature at its worst helps you understand human nature across the entire spectrum of society, because if you can sort of understand the outlying extremes between the saints and the really bad sinners, then you can understand the middle where most people fall. So
interesting. Wow, yeah, very interesting, Father. And so when you were so you went into landscaping, did you still before you continue that, did you have any thoughts at that time about the priesthood still?
Yeah, actually, so that continued. I continued to think about the priesthood all the way through. And then now, as I went through college, that kind of spur of the moment, just change everything in your life, throw out all your old CDs and, you know, stop you playing sports and do things like that. That kind of impulsive, reactive part of it, you know, in the years afterwards had time to go away. And an actual, like, real prayer life and spiritual life started to, you know, had time to start to develop and things like that. So all through college, I continued to have this draw towards the priesthood and would pray about it as well. Then I graduated college, and whatever it was, the desire was still there, but it wasn't like a firm, all right, you need to now go to this school or whatever, just quite yet. I didn't know really what to do with the degrees I had. But I had been working at this commercial real estate company doing general labor and landscaping and construction and stuff for them. And I thought, well, you know, the office is right across the street. I could maybe work on like the property management side of things and, you know, become white collar, you know, utilize my degree. And so I did. I applied over there. They told me, well, thanks for applying, but we don't actually have a position that's open, but we'll, you know, we'll take an interview because you're working for us in the field, kind of like as a like a courtesy interview and something that you know, maybe if we're interested, we won't have to call, look around. We can just maybe call you at some point if something opens up. Well, I interviewed very well and impressed the person that I was interviewing with, who was the head of the department for the property managers, which was the operations department. And so he thanked me, and a few days later I got and that was the thing too, like you're supposed to have 5 years of experience, and obviously I had zero, so that was the other thing that was like, yeah, we're not really looking to hire, and we're not looking to hire necessarily you, but it was sort of like, okay, we'll give you the courtesy of this because you've worked for us for 5 years. So I went to the interview and I did well at the interview, and a few days later I got a call back and saying, you know, we really liked what we heard in the interview. Would you be interested in coming in and giving another interview with the president and CEO of the company? And I said, yeah, of course. So I did that. And apparently that must have gone well, because a few days later, you know, I'm brought back in from the field, and they say, listen, okay, next week you'll start. We still don't have a position open, but maybe we just don't understand that we actually do need you. And if you can prove to us that you're needed here, then maybe it turns into a full-time position. And if not, we'll send you back out to the field. And if something opens up, then we'll let you know. And I'm like, okay. And that's all I needed was a chance. So then, you know, if there's anything to volunteer for, I was there. Like, oh, you need that ticket down to this, you know, the, you know, this building, I'll take it down there. Oh, you need me to, you need somebody to check up on that space, I could check it out. Oh, you need somebody to show somebody, that's, I'll show them it. I'll do that inventory. And, you know, after a month, they're like, okay, well, we need you.
Nice.
So it was like, you're on full time. Exactly. All it's all you need is just a little of you know, give me a chance and I'll give you the you know, the hard work. And so that worked out well, and I loved the job. I really did. It was a position, you know, it's a multi-billion dollar company. We ended up, while I was there, because of a building that we built that was very unique, we ended up being ranked number 17 in Building Magazine for the country, for commercial real estate companies. And I had the sky was the limit for my growth that I could do in the industry. I could really have advanced, made a full career out of it, really. And I loved it. And, in fact, I ended up being the property manager for the CFRI when they were starting looking for a more permanent place for Mass. You know, that they needed like a rental space and everything. So, you know, I was like, all right, well, you know, let me show you some spaces. I got some ideas here. And so for a little while, I was their property manager, which was pretty funny. Just showing Sister Bernadette around to lease spaces, you know? So, when that was done, but then after a while, I think I was there doing that for like 8 months. And then, but that bug of, you know, wanting to become a priest always kept chewing away. And I knew that very shortly something had to be done, or it'd be gone forever, because I knew that everything that was working for the job was working in my favor, that they were going to, I was at my next review, everything was expected from me, because in that probationary type of time frame, even though I got hired on full time, I still was getting paid as like a landscaper. You know, I was getting paid hourly. I was still getting paid at the, you know, a little bit over the rate that I was making before. But subsequent to my next review, now I was going to be salary based. I was going to be getting a very large, you know, pay increase for that point, potentially, you know, a promotion and things like that. I knew that was all coming up, and I knew that with that would become more job satisfaction and getting set into this world, you know. And but the priesthood kept nagging at the back of my brain, and I thought, if I don't go, I'll never go, and then I'll find myself too old to go, and I'll miss it, and I'll always wonder, should I or shouldn't I have? And I had this strong desire to be a priest. So I talked to my boss. I said, you know, everything's going like wonderfully for your career, and then all of a sudden you sit down and say, listen, this is, you know, I got to go. I thought there was, yeah, okay, well, don't let the door, you know, hit you on the way out type of thing, and see you later. You know, we put all this time and effort in doing this training and everything like that to bring you up to speed. But it was totally the opposite. So I was ready to just be canned and forgotten about, to go to the seminary. But instead, they were extremely supportive. They said they understood completely. They respected my decision. And then they actually told me that anytime during the summer, when I came back during the summertime, I could continue. I could just pick up where I left off and keep working during the summers off, because it facilitated all the other property managers to go on their vacations. So I would just fill in and cover for people in the summer. And so I had a job, had some income in the summertime, and then in the return, they would help them out too. So,
and do you think so, Father, that, yeah, their decision to support you, do you think that helped you in furthering your vocation and becoming a priest? Was that a step, do you think?
No, I don't think so. I think it was just really just a pure act of kindness. I mean, there's a nice thing, because I was, like I said, I was expecting to be to walk out the door and just be like, okay, well, thank you. But, and then my spot be filled and forgotten about, you know, I was willing to, I had, you know, you have to, I think unlike a lot of people that ended up going to the seminary, you know, there's some benefit in, I would never recommend somebody to wait to be older and go through college and everything. So I think a lot of vocations are lost that way, but there are some accidental benefits that came from it. And one, I think, is having a little bit more maturity and having a little bit more ability to understand like risk. And it wasn't, now the decision to go wasn't impulsive like it would have been if I was 18, like, you know, the other decisions I had made in life. Now it was a well thought out, prayed about decision. And it was one that I knew that, okay, if they're going to fire me, well, that's, or not fire me, if I'm going to leave and that's the end of this job, and this weren't to, well, first off, I really do think that I have this vocation. And if it didn't, well, I know the recipe for success. I can work hard anywhere and I'll find another job, you know? And so that was, so yeah, I didn't expect them to do it and didn't really make it one way or the other. It just was very, very nice of them to do so. And they even said that if I at any point along the way decide not to become a priest, that they would bring me back in that same position. So, which they certainly didn't have to do. Especially, I mean, I was only new, I was really starting out, but you know, I think it was a very good sort of like relationship that was built between me and the company. And so I think that there was that respectfulness towards that. And I think they respected the fact that it was a decision made not to just go to some other company, but it was one that clearly was one that, you know, requires certain aspect of character person. So I think there's that aspect to it too.
And so where did you end up next then, Father? So obviously you decided to join the seminary. So where did you go?
So I started under Father Kevin Valancourt, who just passed away. Just 2 days.
Yeah, right. Wow.
And so that was a decision made because at the time my primary influence and mentor, the one who brought me into to understand the situation in the church with Saint David Cantism and to understand, you know, where I could go to mass and couldn't go to mass, like, was Bishop McKenna. No relation to me, but I knew him very well. And so when I started talking seriously about seminary, I told him, you know, I really would, at that point I'd known him for years, and I said, I really would like you to be involved in my, at least doing the orders for me. And he said, well, if you want me to have involvement in your seminary training, he's like, I could recommend the Institute of Mater Dei Bonaconsigli, Mater Bonaconsigli over in Turin, Italy. Or if you could convince him to take on another student, I would trust Father Valancourt to train you. And at the time I had asked him, I said, well, you know, like, not, you know, Most Holy Trinity and Bishop Sanborn. And at that particular time, I don't know what it was, and I don't care to know what it was. I just know that they had a disagreement and they had a falling out, and Bishop McKenna viewed it as, well, he wouldn't want me to, because he said, I have no problems with you going to study down there. I just don't think that he would let me be part of like doing your orders or something like that. Mm-hmm. And because they had had this fight, I said, okay, fine. Well, then, so for me, not knowing any of the people involved, that sort of made up my decision. And I applied both to Turin and to Father Valancourt, and, you know, was accepted by both, and then made the decision to go to Father Valancourt because of the fact that, well, I didn't have to, you know, like, do all my learning in French and Italian. So that would be easy. Yeah. So that was, so that was the deciding factor. And so I went out to Father Valancourt. We started with studies, and then by Christmas break, I had gone back to Bishop McKenna just to visit for Christmas and that of that first year of seminary. And he said, oh, by the way, Bishop Martin and I have, you know, we've exchanged Christmas cards, everything's good. And, you know, anybody else that wants to study, I can recommend them to MHT as well. But at that point, my die was already cast. I was already in a place. I was happy. And I had no reason to change. And so that's how that kind of peculiar pathway was set, where I was studying at Our Lady of Guadalupe Church was.
And where was that, Father? I know very little about Father Valancourt.
So that was in Spokane, Washington. Ah, so okay. He had, so it's only, I think, 7 miles away down the road from Mount St. Michael's out there. Okay. He had originally been CMRI priest. He was ordained mm-hmm. by Bishop Musey in 1985. He had been there for a long time before that, during the early days. He was ordained in 1985, and then at a certain point they had gone their separate ways. He had split from CMRI, and then I think there was a lot from that of fallout from the years after they had gotten rid of Schuchart that had left a lot of people looking for sort of like a different option. And so when he left the mount and sort of got everything kind of basically under control, like there was some people that were there still to be served. And so and so that's how that whole entire chapel got set up, Our Lady of Guadalupe Church. And so it was that's how that that's where he was. And so he had built, and then he built up that, it was started off as a small sort of like little chapel. When I was there, he had two masses on a Sunday, and it was like 120 people that were going there. So, I mean, just goes to show how many traditional Catholics are in the Spokane area. It's a very, very big trad Catholic area. So there was plenty to go around. And so it worked out, pretty well. He ended up having, along the way, at a certain point, Bishop McKenna decided he wasn't going to do any more orders. So he had done my tantra, my all of minor orders, and then made a public statement that he wasn't going to continue on doing any orders at all. And then so I went to him and said, whoa, what about me? He's like, you're partway done with me. He's like, oh, I forgot all about you, actually, when I made the statement. But it was, it's like, oh, thanks. And he's like, well, the statement is my statement is the statement, and I'm not going to go back on it. And he's like, but I can recommend you to anybody. And so, and then at that point, that's when he, Bishop Dolan had gone out once or twice to do confirmations for Father Valancourt. So that's when we got in touch with Bishop Dolan, and he agreed to continue on with overseeing my studies and performing the orders along the way. So
interesting. So you kind of have kind of various connections, Father. That is, as you said, more of an unusual path, but it's really interesting. And it's something that I have a little bit of a story with Bishop McKenna, that I was a little boy, an altar boy, in Denver, Colorado, with Father Eugene Berry, who was one of the nine that left the SSBX. Mm-hmm. And Bishop McKenna came to give confirmations one year, and we served mass for him. And I was, 8 or 9 years old. And he said it slightly different right. And he said it very slowly. And yeah. I just remember being times like, bowing down, and I don't remember when, saying some prayers and like, where's our cue? Where's the cue? We're just like bowed down, bent over. It's like, is it going to end? Do we get up? And I just remember kind of panicking as a little 8-year old, like, are we doing something wrong? But I remember specifically too, that he was a very kind and humble. I remember even as a boy really thinking, wow. I mean, I remember thinking he's very old and he's very kind. And it really struck me even at the time. It was a great honor to have been able to serve for him even just that one time.
Yeah, I always say about when people want to know about Bishop McKenna and everything, one of the most important things for me with my relationship with him was that he's one of the few people that I ever met where I didn't, I usually would go down and try to talk, have a chance to talk to him and meet with him and things like that. And but even if I was just there and attended mass and didn't get a chance to pick his ear a little bit or something like that, talk to him a little, just, he was one of those very few people that just seeing him made me want to be more holy, made me want to be better. He just had this, like this personal piety that couldn't help but almost sort of like radiate out in a sense. I don't want to make it like I don't like I'm canonizing the man, you know, in that way, but it's just some people just, you know, like you can really tell when it's a piety that is just 100% sincere, non-affected. You know, you could be looking through the window and him not know you there, and you would still see the same piety, you know, exude from the man. And so that that was always really struck me about him, that just seeing him made me want to be better. He was also just, like you said, very kind, very patient, very, you know, I was just I was just a kid, really, you know, in the early 20s, like, you know, late teens when I met him and for the first time, and, you know, early 20s till I went to seminary, you know, 24 years old or whatever it was. You know, so he didn't have to give me any time, but he gave me lots of time and was very patient. And so yeah, he was extraordinary in that way. And that was the sad thing I was talking to Bishop McGuire about the other day when I found out that Father Valancourt died. I had this realization that all of my clerical mentors were dead, because Father Valancourt was the last of them. And all except for Bishop McKenna happened in the last 2 years. So it was, wow. So Bishop McKenna had died a number of years ago, but then, you know, it was Father Chicada in 2020. Then Father Backtiger, who said mass for years up in Massachusetts. Father Procopio, who was ordained in like 1944 as a Franciscan, was a missionary down in Central America. He came to stay with us in Massachusetts for a year or two, and at the church that we were at, and I would spend, his life story was literally like out of a martyrology. He was like a real missionary riding on mules through the jungle fighting against communists. And, wow. You know, in Honduras he and two others were the first four priests let back into Honduras after they had banned all foreign clergy, which essentially eliminated all the clergy from Honduras.
This sounds like another good podcast, Father. I'm going to have you on to talk about Father Procopio. You got to watch out. You got to watch out what you say on my podcast. I'm going to have you back because that sounds fascinating. I'd love to hear these stories of these hero priests. That's incredible.
Yeah, that'd be a good one, and it deserves to be put down somewhere like that too. So he died. He was like 104. He died in the last year to a year and a half, and then Bishop Dolan and now Father Valancourt. So it was, I mean, in the last 2 years to lose 3, 4, 5 priests that were all my mentors and people that I really, really learned a lot from, you know, it's kind of a sobering moment. You life just kind of goes on and you, like, one person dies, you think, okay, that's sad. But to kind of just all of a sudden have that reflection back and realize, like, oh my goodness, there's so many and they're all gone. And those were the people that had the most influence on me becoming a priest or me doing the things that I did. You know, the work that I do as a priest, as a mission, doing the missions throughout, you know, it's greatly facilitated by what I learned from Father Procopio and his foreign missions. And, Father Backtiger, another person who exuded a lot of virtue in terms of charity and patience and you know, just constant care of people as needed. And, and then all that I learned in the 10 plus years that I've been here at St. Gertrude's from Bishop Dolan, Father Chicada, and everything. So, you know, it's just, it was a sobering reality, but that he was gone. That's a heavy point, I guess, of this podcast a little bit, but it is true. He had a big part of all of, you know, and that was the great part about going to him at Our Lady of Guadalupe, was not only was he a good teacher and a smart man, but it offered sort of like a unique aspect to it that because it wasn't in a brick and mortar seminary type of situation, it was able to combine, you know, we're going to do all of the academic studies, but while you're here, being involved in, okay, you know, teach catechism and things like that, you know, work with the servers, train the servers, etc. But also, remember when we were talking about these principles? Well, here's a situation that came up, and this is how it's a good example. And so there's the pastoral side that was combined with it as like a real sort of like practical application of all the stuff that we were learning. Because, you know, and when you're reading it out of a book, that's all it is. It's information out of a book, and it's, you know, it's an intellectual activity, and it's something that sets down certainly the principles and the firm, you know, grasp on what is important. But when it really matters is when you apply that to souls in the world. You know, that's the work of the priest, and to be, nothing substitutes the actual doing it, part of it. And so but to be able to sort of like witness it along the way and to see it and him patiently explain, you know, this is how we apply these principles in real life, and this is how it's a situation that's good for you to understand, and everything was invaluable as to learn that sort of like pastoral sense, or at least to get the ball started and rolling. So when I was ordained, that it wasn't just purely conceptual, it was actual practical application seen and witnessed and understood too. So.
And so then after your ordination, Father, did you go back to Father Valancourt, or did you go directly to St. Gertrude's with Bishop Dolan?
I went directly here I had finished up at the end when I was, Father Valancourt started having health problems at the end of my studies as well. Plus the fact that, the limitations in what you could do in study of liturgy and things like that at a small parish like that. So all agreed to have me finish up my studies here at St. Gertrude. So as a deacon, I came here actually and finished up with Father Chicada and doing, you know, the last semester or two. I forget exactly how long it took anyways, but last handful of classes and everything like that with me. And then once that was done, being ordained essentially I was back in Massachusetts for a short period of time, but essentially for the most part just been here at St. Gertrude's, and then living on the road for the most after a year or so being here, really the missions I started doing missions almost right away, but you know, after a little bit of time, it was that realization that was where my skills were best applied, and where, you know, the work that I was the happiest doing, I think, you know, to an extent too. I liked that, and it was suited for my personality.
Interesting. Sorry, real quick. Why do you like that? I think that's something that I find really interesting. That I think many priests probably struggle with missions, and I think that makes you unusual. Maybe that you like that. Why is that?
That's a good. I think. Well, people always ask me like, "Oh, you must like to travel a lot," and I think when you do travel a lot, you stop liking to actually travel a lot. But you don't mind travel. So like, I don't mind spending a lot of time on, the amount of time that I've spent on airplanes. I don't mind spending huge amounts of time in the car. Sometimes you actually, being in the car allows you to clear your head a little bit too, which is nice. But the fact that you can do that regularly for a long period of time and then not have it bother you 10 years later. You know, like, I mean, I tell people, it's like, you know, last year I had over 150 flight segments, you know, in the year. So it's, you know, like, and that's just 1 year in comparison to, you know, I've been doing it for 10 years, and that's not counting the thousands and thousands of miles that I drove as well. And it's like, to do that, to live out of a suitcase for more days than you don't, is bothersome. It just does, for whatever reason, it didn't really bother me that much. And so when what I liked about it was I liked getting to be in the dynamic aspect of it, being in a different place with a different set of people, and then getting to appreciate that every mission, you know, was unique from the different place, and that every group had different people, and that every place had its own unique problems, it had its own unique bright spots, it had its own, so it allowed you to, you know, like kind of see so many different aspects of life, and it's taken me all over the world too, which is you know, interesting as well. But it's, yeah, I think it's just, there's something about that, you know, that you're getting to meet really great people and that really desire the sacraments in these kind of small places all over the place, and being able to help them and provide for them in different ways. And then I think there's just an aspect, and that's probably comes down to sort of like the why property management worked out so well as a you know, a job for me too, is that, you know, it's you're overseeing all these different places, and it's like, okay, or starting something up new. All right, this has a group of people that want it, and this is how I can see how I can start that up and run that. And so there's a lot of interesting aspects to it that I found, and for whatever reason, I was able to juggle a lot of the pieces of different places, and I think it's also helpful for that desire. Like I said, Father Procopio, which, as you said, we could talk about more at some point, in the future, him explaining his missionary work certainly was a huge inspiration on me. And then early on in Massachusetts, that's what we were. We all were recipients of missionary masses, priests traveling to come to the Boston area to say mass, you know, Father Benedict Hughes being one of the first ones to come out and say mass for us, you know, Father Gabriel Lavery being, you know, brand spanking new, like oil still wet on his hands, coming out all baby faced and saying mass for us. Still pretty baby faced, even though he's and that being influential and seeing, you know, priests that were willing to travel across the country just to bring us the sacraments, and made me think like, yeah, this is how important these are. This is why they do that, and it made me want to do the same. Like, you know, to share to be able to take care of people that otherwise wouldn't be able to get the sacraments. So, you know,
it's a beautiful thing, Father. I mean, it's incredible. And I have, you know, other friends who are priests who do these just incredible missions too, you know, these mm-hmm. 20 hours of driving in 2 days. I mean, just ridiculous, really. I mean, like truck drivers. So they're like truck drivers, yeah. And they're having confessions and giving mm-hmm. the sacraments and praying mass. And then they go back and teach. And it's just, yeah, like, this is insane. This is like inhuman. It shouldn't even be possible what they're doing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it is. I mean, there are points in heaven for it. It's incredible. It's sincerely heroic what these priests do. I mean, I don't know if people appreciate that enough. Really, the sacrifices of the traveling priest. Wow.
I think it was a good thing. It was sort of even like pre and tone when Bishop Dolan did my ordination in the sermon that he gave at my ordination. Which is funny because generally speaking, I don't really remember much about the sermon because that whole day, that's why I always tell people getting married, like, don't worry about the details. It's all going to be a blur anyways. It just, right. You know, just, right. So it's, but the, you know, I remember little bits of that sermon. And one of the things was when he was talking about how, like, a priest, you know, is meant to, you know, put himself at risk, and also to sacrifice of himself to take care of the faithful. Like, that is his duty, you know, like it's supposed to be a selfless vocation, you know, it doesn't belong to me. The sacraments don't belong to me. I'm the steward of the sacraments, you know, but they're the normal means in which the faithful get to heaven. And so do what you can to get them those sacraments and get them, you know, that that time to. And I also, you know, you also appreciate the people in those, like being somebody that was the recipient of missionary work sacraments, you know, you appreciate it, you learn from that too. Like, what if, all right, if I was still on the receiving end of this, what would I want more of? And, you know, one of the things like I noticed that I adjusted for myself was that I always made it a point wherever I went to let the people know, like, here's my cell phone number, here's my email address. Just because I'm not always here doesn't mean that I'm not your pastor. Like, so you always have access to me. Just, you know, like, I might not always answer, I might not always get back to you right away. If you don't hear from me in a day or two, just remind me. But it's not because I'm ignoring you. It's just, but you know, I'm really am yours, and you know, you can contact me anytime you need to. And so kind of like trying to make people in the missions feel less like they're in the missions, you know, and more like they had somebody actually there, I think was a big learning point too. And but yeah, it's just that idea. I mean, like I said, it's the candle. It's not supposed to be placed under the bushel, right? It's supposed to shine out throughout all the corners of the house. And that's, no, I think that's the idea of the priesthood, is that it's not meant to be just kept to oneself or kept to, you know, what's comfortable. You know, the priest is, he doesn't belong to himself anymore. So, you know, you work until you exist, you can no longer work anymore. And you go out and take care of people until you're no longer needed. And then that's when, you know, that's when you die. So,
well, you came onto my radar, Father, first. It must have been, I don't even know now, sometime during the whole pandemic. And I saw someone shared something on Facebook or something, because I don't even know if I probably heard your name before, but I saw a picture of you on an empty airplane. And it was just like, it was really remarkable, and it really struck me. I was like, whoa, you know, that's pretty incredible. First of all, that you're willing to risk it, because I think it was fairly early on where most of us really weren't real sure what the whole thing was. We didn't really know how dangerous it was. And yeah. So I think we were all pretty like, okay, mandates, all that. We were skeptical, but still pretty unsure. And to see you on the plane by yourself, and real quickly, before I ask you about that, we had just also, I think, recently gone to Assisi and to the tomb of St. Clair. And when you go down to the tomb, there is a sign that says, it had crossed out, I think it had crossed out, or you had, you know, wear your mask, keep distance, and no praying. They literally had a little girl kneeling, or a woman kneeling down, X'd out. I'm not even
kidding. Oh my goodness.
During a pandemic, they had a no praying sign at the tomb of a saint. And it was just, I think it was around this time that I saw you too. I was like, okay, well, here's a priest doing something right while others are just, you know, or other priests are just leaving their flocks.
Yeah. Well, that was the thing. I think, I mean, from the beginning, there's a couple aspects that went into it. First off is that the number one thing, that as soon as I heard about it, this whole entire COVID idea, my first thought was, well, I'm going to have to take care of parishioners. And if this thing is as scary as the media is making it out to be, well, then I'm going to get it. Like, that's it. I mean, there's just no, you know, and what I think there's a certain amount of like, oh, you know, when you have like, when it's not like fear comes in from the unknown, right? So you're afraid of something that you don't actually know really what the outcome is going to be. And when you have eliminated the unknown part of it, then there's nothing, you know, like, you're afraid that you might get sick, but when you know you're going to, you're just like, eh, okay, well, that's just going to be it. Right. Sure. And so it's sort of like, you know, if there's like a confrontation going on around you and things are sort of like tensities building up and things could snap off at some point, you know, you're like, oh man, I don't want to get into a fight. I don't want to get hurt somehow doing this or whatever. But when you're backed into like a there is no way out situation, then it's not fear anymore. It's just, okay, I guess I'm getting in a fight now. And that's, you know, you're just, that's it. Like, there's no way around it. You just accept that it's going to happen. And so there was that sort of aspect to it that early on, at the very beginning, was just I'll get it some one way or another. There's no way I'm not going to take care of the people that, and my people are scattered all over the country. So, you know, I'm going to have to do this. Of course, we didn't know what kind of, like, nobody could foresee that the government was going to try to shut down,
right,
you know, as much as it did. So, like, the idea of ending up on planes by yourself, it wasn't some sort of like thought that well, this is the way this is going to happen. It just, all of a sudden you end up at the airport and you realize, oh my goodness, there's nobody here. And wait a second, I'm in Chicago O'Hare, and why is there music? Oh, I never even knew that they played music through speakers here, because you can never hear it over the noise of people. But now there's nobody here. And, you know, it's just, it's creepy. But yeah, that's, so there's that aspect to it. Plus, on top of it, I think I had a pretty good feel of the pulse of what it actually was early on, thanks to medical people and scientists that are actually, I was fortunate to have as parishioners. You know, one of my parishioners in North Dakota has a doctorate in molecular biology and biochemistry, and, you know, and was very, very early on, you know, like, had looked into, you know, genetic sequencing that was out there and that was being publicized, and was pointing to the fact that this is man-made, that it is impossible to be, because of that, is pointing to the fact that it wasn't as dangerous as they were saying it was going to, be. And then that carried on right through the idea when they came out with the vaccines. You know, he also saying, you know, pointing out, he wrote an article, beautiful article. He actually wrote it for his work, because he worked at the time for the USDA in a laboratory. And everybody all of a sudden had to wear masks. And he's like, we are an entire laboratory of scientists. Everybody here knows that these don't do anything against viruses. Why are we wearing masks? And so, like, he ended up writing an article for his work that I also shared online through my own social media at that time and everything, about the ineffectual aspects of masks. Like, people don't realize that surgeons aren't technically required to wear masks in operating room, because it doesn't matter. You know, the only reason why the mask is worn is, like, when you have an open cavity, that you're not spitting part of your tuna sandwich from lunch, and when you're asking for the scalpel, you know, it's not to protect from a viral infection, because it won't do anything in that regard. And so the you know, all of the steps along the way, you know, he and others, you know, were on top of it, and we were having regular discussions about it. And so, and, you know, especially, like I said, I had other medical personnel who knew and things like that, doctors and nurses and such, but having the scientist field to be, you know, expert to help me through that, and really take the time to explain to me why, you know, like, his rationale behind it and his findings and everything. And it was all the stuff that he was talking about early on is all the stuff that is now being, you know, shown to be exactly what was said from the beginning, you know, that, you know, all the warnings that we sounded early on about the jab, you know, that, you know, it wasn't going to work. It was going to be harmful. It was going to cause infertility, that it was going to potentially lead to rising cancer, that it was going to cause blood clots and heart attacks and strokes. And, you know, like, all of the rationale, it was like all the things that were spouted off about it when it first came out, was because of understanding, because he understood what the technology was and what the effects that it could potentially have, and he would be the one to read all of their own documentation and realize, like, well, this is right in their own stuff here. And so that's why I think we were able to sort of champion it earlier. And besides the fact, even if it was going to be an actual pandemic, which we all know it wasn't, my mindset and all the clergy here was, if it were to be bad, if there's one place that people should have that they can go to with confidence, it should be church, right? Like, we are people of faith. So, you know, like, if you know, like, why shouldn't people be able to come and pray, you know? And that's, and so that's why we never changed anything. We never closed, we never social distanced, we never masked, we never removed holy water, we never, you know, taped off pews, we never, you know, did anything. And because it was, no, like, the world's going banana land. You need a place that you can come and have confidence. And if you're going to have, if you're going to pray for deliverance from this thing and expect it to work, you have to have confidence that your prayer works. And if I'm going to stand over you looking like I'm a Martian because I'm in a space suit, that doesn't really breathe confidence into your prayer life. You know, that I'm so terrified that you need to stay 6 feet away from me, or don't touch the sacramental holy water, or something, you know, like these things. It's like, no,
don't,
like,
pray at a tomb, right? Yeah,
don't pray at a tomb. Exactly. It's like, the world needs more of this stuff. And that's why we were able to do what we do. But that was just talk about just a bizarre time. And then the amount of flights I had to go on with a mask afterwards, which was just crazy. That was you could tell the mind manipulation so well with the whole mask thing, because when, after I had been on whatever, a year and a half worth of flying with masks, you know, 200 plus flights with masks on, then all of a sudden it's like, okay, well, you no longer required to leave, have a mask on. And you almost want to start like thanking them that you cannot, that now you, right, can stop wearing a mask. You're like, wait a second, like, I should have never had to wear this in the first place, you know, like, but you realize, like, that's the psychological, like, oh, we're back to normal. Like, no, we're not back to normal. We've just, they've given you your quote unquote rights back temporarily to hold on to, you know. It's sort of like, you know, when in the Andy Griffith show, when trouble really started, then he would give Barney Fife the bullet for his gun, you know, if he had to use it. So, it's like they're just lending it to you, your rights to you. They're not actually rights anymore. So, like, a lot has, you know, that was a wild time. It's a strange thing to come onto your radar screen for, I guess, but hey, whatever works.
Right. You never know with social media, right? I mean, it was pretty interesting. I can remember the picture, like, oh, there's a priest alone on the airplane. It's like, I wonder who that is. Father McKenna. And I immediately thought, I think I asked someone, I was like, is he somehow related to Bishop McKenna? Because of course you shared the same name, but,
right.
But Father, I'm really glad to have gotten to meet you, at least cyberly, even though now my camera shuts off for no good reason whatsoever. But, you know, some things never change. Technical issues will always continue. You know, that's just how it is. But exactly. Father, I really appreciate you coming on and hearing your story, and I really hope to have you on again. I'd love to hear about, you know, these priests that inspired you, because I think, as you say, I mean, with all of them passing away so recently, it's so important, mm-hmm, to make sure that their stories are told, that we know what they did, and, you know, that we know who these heroes are that passed the torch of tradition and that kept faith literally alive. Exactly. And I think that's so important to keep that in people's minds and for them to know about it. So I hope I can have you on again, Father.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, I'd love to. So that'd be great.
Great. Father, do you have any last words? I know we didn't really talk about your roles now or St. Gertrude's is great, but we had a really nice chat with Father Leitoranta, who gave us a pretty good rundown of St. Gertrude's yesterday. That was very nice. Great to meet him as well.
Excellent. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for my roles here now, you know, it's shifted a lot. I still do some of the mission work, but some of that work is, you know, we're gradually working in, or maybe even a little slightly not so gradually, just because of necessity, working in the young priests into doing more, you know, some more of the travel and things like that. My work becomes a lot more, you know, administrative, which is a lot less enjoyable than bringing sacraments to people and everything like that, you know, but it's also necessary. So, you know, here basically helping the bishop, you know, to help run our apostolate and kind of oversee, you know, all that's going on. So, you know, that's a big part of what I'm doing now is that, you know, that assistance to him. So, but, you know, besides that, yeah, we still continue with everything. The liturgy here, the you know, all of our church in Milwaukee, all of our missions all around, all of our priests throughout the world and everything like that, you know, that's that the apostolate continues on. So
it's great, Father, and I appreciate it. I see often your posts on social media about the, maybe not yours, but from St. Gertrude's, about the, you know, from the liturgy, from the live liturgy, the choir is beautiful, the liturgy is beautiful. And I think that's something that's so important again, too, is to remind people, you know, the beauty of the faith. I think we spend so much time fighting or arguing or saying how bad the Novus Ordo is. Like, hey, look, yeah, you know, we've got it. We have got literally it. It is ours. And that is an incredible, incredible thing we should never take for granted.
For sure. I think it was, I can't remember which one. It was either Saint, I think it was Saint Teresa of Avila. It might have been Saint Teresa of Lisieux, but you know, I think it was Saint Teresa of Avila that said that she would willingly die for the smallest of the rubrics of the Mass. So, you know, that kind of sentiment, you know, to come to the understanding of, you know, every time trying to be perfect in the celebration of the liturgy, and also to be able to have a place, like you said, the choir is works very hard, and they're very good. Our servers work really, really hard, and they're very good. You know, the ceremonies here, we all, you know, regularly are studying rubrics of the ceremonies so that we get them right. And because, like I said at the beginning, somebody showing up for the first time and all of a sudden walking in and seeing that, it is a conversion tool in and of itself, and it is something that is directly for the love and service of God. So you put your focus and effort on stuff like that, and that's what, you know, Bishop Dolan very well instilled that into us, the lover of the liturgy and everything, and something that we very, very much are focused on. You know, staying that course for sure. So yeah, that's
perfect. Beautiful, Father. I really appreciate it. And until next time, until I hope we have a podcast again talking about these hero priests and anything else. I love your opinions on what's going on in the world. I'll pick your brain one of these days too, I hope. But until then, God bless you, Father.
God bless you too.